Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this very day, back in 1911, that famed composer and conductor Gustav Mahler died. What were his last words? Was it A, I kept telling them I was sick? Is it B, Mozart? Was it C, I must go in, the fog is rising? Or was it D, friends applaud, the comedy is finished? So what were Gustav Mahler's last words on this, his last day, back in 1911? And question number two, it was on this very day, back in which year, that the song Tiptoe Through the Tulips was a number one hit? Was that A, 1929, B, 1945, C, 1968, or D, 1980? So in which year did this famous tune reach number one? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of May the 16th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 2000, that the Britney Spears album Oops, I Did It Again was released. Hard to believe that that was already a quarter century ago. Oops, I Did It Again, all the way back in the year 2000. And it was 59 years ago today, 1966, that the Beach Boys album Pet Sounds was released. Initially promoted as the most progressive pop album ever, Pet Sounds is recognized for its ambitious production, sophisticated harmonic structures, and coming-of-age themes. It is widely regarded as among the greatest and most influential albums in music history. The Beatles, for example, were deeply impressed by that album. They considered it a groundbreaking and influential work, inspiring them to push their own creative boundaries. Indeed, George Martin said that without Pet Sounds, Sgt. Pepper's would have never been made. And in classical music news, this article is titled Death at the Keyboard, a pianist's final fatal performance at Carnegie Hall. This is published in BBC Music Magazine by Terry Blaine on the 25th of April, 2025. On the evening of 2 April 1951, the 54-year-old Simone Barret stepped on stage at Carnegie Hall, New York, to play Grieg's perennially popular piano concerto. It was, remarkably, the first time Barre had ever performed the piece in public, despite his reputation as a scintillating virtuoso of strong poetic instincts. At first, all seemed well, as conductor Eugene Ormandy cued the Philadelphia Orchestra for the timpani roll and crashing chord which opened the Grieg Concerto. Mr. Barre appeared to be in top form. The New York Times reviewer Olin Downs wrote, "His entrance solo was brilliantly delivered." Soon, though, Downs became puzzled by irregularities in Barre's performance, whose pace seemed excessively fast. Then, just after the cellos had announced the movement's second theme, came disaster. Downs initially thought Barre had bent sideways to listen with a special attention to the instruments as he matched his tone with theirs, but then the pianist's left hand slipped from the keyboard, and he instantly fell senseless from the stool to the floor. The orchestra stopped playing in consternation, and shouts went up for a doctor. Barre was carried from the stage with some difficulty and taken to a dressing room. Police and an ambulance were summoned, and for half an hour attempts were made to revive the stricken pianist. They were in vain. Barre never regained consciousness and was subsequently pronounced by the medical examiner to have died of a spontaneous cerebral hemorrhage. The concert in the hall had meanwhile continued on the assumption that Barre had suffered a fainting fit or some other non-life-threatening incident. The Swedish tenor Seth Sevenholm performed a song cycle with the most admirable expressiveness and control, wrote Downs, and a planned interval followed. But the rest of the program was never completed. When the orchestra reassembled to play Nielsen's Fifth Symphony, a shocked audience was told Barre had died, and it was the feeling of all the musicians taking part in the concert that it should be abandoned. Barre's wife, Helen, and son, Boris, were in Carnegie Hall that evening. The sheer awfulness of what they saw and experienced can only be imagined. In such a horrifying way was Barre's life cut short, the end of a career path that itself had been anything but smooth. Born in Odessa in 1896, Barre was the 11th of 13 children in an impoverished Jewish family. When his father died unexpectedly, the youthful Barre earned money for the family by playing in silent movie theaters and restaurants. The death of his mother when he was 16 was another serious setback, but Barre plowed on. A scintillating audition gained him admission to the St. Petersburg Imperial Conservatory, and he spent 7 years there learning his brilliant natural talent. The composer, Glusinov, the conservatory's director, bent the usual rules designed to keep Jews from attending and ensured Barre stayed long enough to avoid conscription for World War I military service. Barre finally graduated in 1919 with the Rubinstein Prize, the conservatory's top award for pianists. A glittering future beckoned, but instead he had to battle constantly with adversity. At first confined to Russia, he eventually left for Latvia, where his wife and son joined him. In 1932, the family decamped to Berlin, just as National Socialism and anti-Semitism were on the rise. For a period, Barre was reduced to playing in vaudeville shows anonymously for money. A shift to London followed, and the attention that his performances gleaned there brought an invitation first to the U.S. and then his Carnegie Hall debut in November 1936. New York loved Barre and what one critic called the superb technique and his command of sensitively managed singing tone. The years of wandering in Europe with their stop-start impact on his career development seemed finally to be over. The 1940s were good to Barret, and by the time he walked briskly on to the Carnegie Hall platform on that fateful day in 1951, he had a global reputation as a viscerally exciting performer. A tragic and fatal performance, but a lasting legacy. The following day, the pianist's body was taken to lie in state at Riverside Memorial Chapel, a Jewish funeral home in Manhattan. From 1 p.m. to 10 p.m., at least 500 persons had viewed Mr. Barret's body. The New York Times reported, Olin Downs had no doubt about the stature of the musician the classical community had lost. There was no more modest, studious, and sincere artist, he wrote admirably. He leaves not only a great, but an enviable reputation behind him. And in music research and technology, we have this article titled, Jennifer Higdon Won't Apologize for Writing Accessible Music. As one of the most performed living composers, the Pulitzer winner insists that her music communicate to everyone, from farmers to children to the classical music intelligentsia. This is a special series, The Composer Interview, published in NPR on the 25th of April, 2025, by Tom Huizinga. Accessible can be a dirty word in contemporary classical music. For decades, composers have outfitted their works with gnarly tangles of complexity, and heaven forbid if there's a tune you can hum. That music rightfully has its cheerleaders, but composer Jennifer Higdon isn't among them. She is a vigorous defender of melody, and when her music is described as accessible, she doesn't wince, she rejoices. Traditional-sounding melody, harmony, and rhythm are Higdon's building blocks, but her works are anything but old-fashioned. They tend to percolate with an organic freshness and a musical language that's large in vocabulary but easy to grasp. Across her career, she has pulled off the near-impossible feat of walking the fine line between classical music fanatics and first-timers, satisfying both camps. When Higdon writes music, whether it's her operatic adaptation of Cold Mountain, chamber works, or any of her 15 concertos, she insists that it communicates, that it's capable of being understood and appreciated. So far, the 62-year-old Brooklyn native's track record is a success. Her music routinely receives upwards of 250 performances per year, and she's won a Pulitzer Prize and three Grammys. She likes to tell stories of finding fans in muddy-booted farmers and little girls who didn't know someone who looks like their mom could write music for a symphony orchestra. A frank, easygoing conversationalist with remnants of an accent from her childhood in East Tennessee, Higdon joined me on a video call from her home studio in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, to talk about how she came late to the classical music bandwagon, the importance of supporting women composers, and why her new opera, Women with Eyes Closed, which receives its world premiere this month in Pittsburgh, has three different endings. The author asks, You are unapologetic about your music being described as accessible. That's a word many composers would not want associated with their music, right? She answers, It doesn't bother me in the least, because I think the whole point of what I'm doing is to speak to people. To me, accessible is an incredible compliment. Which is not to say your music is simplistic. The concerto for orchestra, for example, or your first opera, Cold Mountain, those are very sophisticated works, and Some pop music is also quite sophisticated. The Beatles, Radiohead, Beyoncé. Do you think of your music as on the pop side of classical, in terms of how easy it is on the ears and how easy it is to comprehend? She answers, that would not have occurred to me because I watched the struggle to put those pieces together. When I write pieces, I say, it's going to look simple, and you're going to think, oh, this won't be hard. But 100% of the time, when they start assembling the music, everyone goes, oh, wow, this really is difficult. And it's not that pop music isn't difficult. I look at what Alison Krauss does with bluegrass, and some of the layering, Beyoncé's Lemonade kind of blew me away with all the layers, the shifting tones, the way she told the story. In essence, we're all storytellers, and we try to find the thing that feels true to us, but also that will get that information out beyond our own imaginations. We'll try to continue this discussion with her at some point in future programs. And once again, that composer was Jennifer Higdon, H-I-G-D-O-N. And in rock and pop music news, it's a continuation of the hidden meanings behind these classic rock songs article that was published in the March 1st, 2025 issue of Grunge Magazine by Joshua McCoy. Musicians frequently tie their glorious riffs and rhythms to the events of the day and the goings-on in their lives, drawing from a deep well of unique personal inspiration. In the 1980s, for example, rock bands felt larger than life back in the era of glam, hair metal, and arena rock, when bands like Blondie, The Police, and Chicago scored the most prominent hits of the year, and a legendary producer founded the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That all-consuming popularity led to some unfortunate assumptions by anti-rock crusaders who often reduced the entire genre down to fast cars, pretty girls, and all the drugs a body can handle. By comparison, modern rock might be up in the air, but those glory days of rock and roll actually come with a shocking world of hidden interpretations. While every band has its fair share of unambiguous songs, there are a ton of classic rock tracks that hide their true message behind layers of poetry. The hidden meaning behind these classic rock songs will bring a lot of joy to future listeners. For example, With or Without You is about Bono's relationship with himself. U2 is one of the biggest bands in the world, but while it had tremendous success in Europe in the band's early days, it took five albums to truly top the charts in the United States. The first single from that album, The Joshua Tree, was With or Without You, a massive power ballad that, at the time, represented the height of the band's critical and commercial success. U2 would, of course, go on to top that accomplishment multiple times, but With or Without You, that song, remains one of the most iconic tracks. As of March 2024, the song was U2's most played entry on Spotify, having just passed 1 billion streams. Anyone could tell you that With or Without You is about an impossible relationship, but U2's Bono has taken a more introspective stance on its lyrics. Instead of focusing on a doomed affair between two parties, U2's biggest hit is at least partially about two halves of Bono's personality. U2 famously kept up a brutal touring schedule that separated Bono from his family for long periods of time, leaving him in a poor mental space that led him to write the song. Speaking to Rolling Stone in 1986, he explained that he found it almost impossible to be married and be in a band on the road, prompting the bittersweet song, With or Without You. Finally, in local music news, we have this article titled, Raleigh is Getting a New Live Music Venue. Here's what to know about it. This is written by Renee Umstead and News and Observer, MSN.com, on the 26th of April, 2025. In his decades as a musician, James McMillan has played a variety of bands, metal, blues, alternative, and even a brief stint in Russian pop. One constant throughout the years has been a struggle to find places to rehearse and perform. In 2021, amid what his wife Cassie Fry called a post-pandemic funk, the couple asked themselves how they wanted to spend their time. Opening a music venue was the answer. A safe place, centrally located, where bands and musicians could practice and play to an audience. We're just trying to cater to local bands who really don't have a following yet and just trying to get in front of a crowd, maybe for the first time, McMillan told the News and Observer in an interview. In coming months, McMillan and Fry plan to open their new business, Cannonball Music Hall, at Salvage Yard in Raleigh Iron Works. An exact opening date has not been announced, as it depends on construction. The Raleigh development checked off several items on their wish list. It's in Raleigh, but not downtown. Has plenty of parking and is close to restaurants. We're not planning on serving food, and we want to make sure that everybody can get what they need without having to go too far, Fry said. Located in the 2,800-square-foot space at 2304 Atlantic Avenue next to Tilden Car Care Center, Cannonball features five rehearsal rooms of varying sizes and a performance space, complete with a stage and bar and room for about 140 people. The practice spaces will be suitable and available for musicians to reserve and can accommodate different uses. Instructors could book a room for a private lesson in one of the smaller spaces, for example, but a band with multiple members could reserve one of the larger rooms for a month, allowing them to leave their equipment on site. Cannonball may eventually provide equipment such as drum kits for the rooms, but for now, the spaces just contain electrical outlets, and plenty of them. Fry and McMillan are also looking into installing an access control system that would allow people who book a practice room to enter the venue as they please. For the performance space, Cannonball's owners hope to have some kind of event 5 days a week. Nightly shows will be scheduled for Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, while Sunday performances will be earlier in the day and low-key. And Wednesday events will be more interactive, like a trivia night or a live band karaoke. We want local music. We want to have local beer, Fry said. We just want this to be a local spot. Visitors can learn about upcoming shows on Cannonball's website and social media pages, and should expect to find many genres represented, jazz, folk, and metal among them. What else is planned for Raleigh Ironworks? Well, there's Fair and Fellow, a local cafe with locations in Durham and Mooresville, is going to be there. Noco Brews and Bites is expected to open this summer at Salvage Yard. St. Pierre Wine Bar, a new wine bar from the team behind Oakwood Pizza Box. And Mamie Nora's, the Peruvian chicken restaurant, is moving to Salvage Yard. So how'd you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this very day back in 1911 that famed composer and conductor Gustav Mahler died. What were his last words? Was it A, I kept telling them that I was sick? Well, no, not really, that wasn't it. How about B, Mozart? Yes, this was Gustav Mahler's last word. And by the way, he had conducted his last concert just a couple of months earlier on February 21st. Was it C, I must go in, the fog is rising? Well, those were actually Emily Dickinson's last words. Or were they D, friends applaud, the comedy is finished? No, it turns out that these were the last words of Ludwig van Beethoven, not Mahler. And the answer to our second question, it was on this very day, back in which year, that the song Tiptoe Through the Tulips was a number one hit. Was it A, 1929, B, 1945, C, 1968, or D, 1980? Correct answer? Well, as noted in OnThisDay.com, that song was a number one hit for singer Nick Lucas back in 1929. Answer A is therefore the correct answer. And by the way, it was on this day, back in 1968, that Tiny Tim released this same tune, but it never made it near the top of the charts, although it was a defining moment in his career. According to Ukulele Magazine, Tiny Tim's distinctive high-pitched singing voice, a falsetto, was a result of his naturally high vocal range and the way he used it. He began singing in his falsetto after hearing a radio duet and deciding to sing both parts in their respective registers. So let's close out today's program with one of the most popular tracks on the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds album, which was released on this very day back in 1966. Here's God Only Knows.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program's also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information, or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.